Hugh Brody, wonderful to speak to you, and thanks so much for joining me.
I'm delighted. I'm absolutely delighted, and this is a piece of Canadian history that I'm always very happy to return to.
So I wanted to start by painting a broader picture or background of the setting and landscape in the years leading up to the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline inquiry. You came to Canada from England in the late 1960s, where you worked with the Northern Science Research Group, which is a
Yes.
social research unit within the Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development. What was it that put Canada on the map for you and compelled you to come here at first?
Well, I first came in 1969, as you say, but in fact, my awareness of and enthusiasm about Canada predates that in at two levels, I think. One is almost a childhood level. When I was perhaps a very young teenager or even younger, I met somebody who lived in the Canadian Maritimes who described life there, and it sounded incredible because of the access you had to rivers and wildlife and birds and open spaces. And so it was a kind of a geographical and even ornithological excitement. And I had this idea that there was a freedom to be had there. And I thought that was naive and just childish fantasizing, and some of it came from a boy who loved the countryside, but some of it was deeper, I think, and was to do with the sense that in Canada there was not the oppression of class. I think even as a very young person, I was aware that there was something in England that had a potential to throttle us all, and it was class and class consciousness, and that Canada, as I understood it from this man, and then probably from other sources at the time, seemed to be without that. That's a very what you might call it, the primitive layer. Much closer to 1969, I had been working on the anthropology of the West of Ireland and looking at rapid cultural and social change in among Irish peasant communities. And in the course of that work, I'd found the literature on what was called culture contact and acculturation. And in it was quite a bit about the Arctic, especially Alaska, a little bit about Greenland, focusing on rapid social change and acculturation. And although I was not gripped by those concepts and quite quickly became very suspicious of them, I was very fascinated by a sense I got from that literature of a frontier that was between modernity and the hunter-gatherer world. And it was that frontier that I wanted to visit. And so I applied for jobs in Canada. I wanted to get to the Canadian Arctic. And I applied everywhere and got turned down by everyone, except for the University of Ottawa offered me a very small kind of fellowship to help me on my way. I think it was worth $250. And then the Northern Science Research Group, having turned down my request to go to the Arctic, said they did need someone to go to Edmonton and look at the whole issue of migrant people, then called Indians, the First Nation, people from First Nations communities who were drifting into prairie towns, particularly Edmonton, in the minds of the people of the Northern Science Research Group. And they asked me to go and spend some time doing on the ground anthropological field work in Edmonton with a view to helping the department understand what lay behind this movement of people, what the conditions were of life on Skid Row in Edmonton, and what they might do about it departmentally or governmentally. A huge undertaking with someone who had never been to Canada and never done urban anthropology. And initially I wrote them and said I couldn't possibly do this. I wasn't qualified, and there didn't seem to be a literature to guide me, and though I turned it down. But in fact, well, somebody from the University of Ottawa heard I turned it down and wrote and said, you shouldn't turn it down. Take it, because you'll end up in the Arctic. So I thought, well, this is my route to the Arctic. It's a rather eccentric route, but still, I agreed to do that job. Went in, I think, June 1969, stayed till October, I think, living on Skid Row at Edmonton. And that's where I discovered Canada. A very surprising place to discover Canada, but it was an astonishing and amazing experience. I met many people from different First Nations, and I did manage to go to the subarctic. I went to Hay River. I went to Haida Gwaii, following people I'd met on Skid Row back to their homes. So I got to see a lot of Canada from and within Edmonton, and that did indeed lead to the Northern South Research Group offering me a contract to go to the Arctic.
This was a really fascinating time for anthropology. Anthropology as a discipline was beginning to
I think
sort
it
of look
was.
inward on itself, and especially around its relationship to applied anthropology, as applied research in the field and going and essentially solving the problems of government. What was the state of government-sponsored social research at that time?
Well, when I first went there, what the core of it seemed to be area, what were called area economic surveys, that the Northern Science Research Group library seemed to be full of area economic surveys, and I kept meeting people who had done work to show what the employment situation was and what the employment potential was, or the housing situation was, or the migration possibilities were of workers from the north to other parts of Canada. They're very basic empirical social science, quantifiable social science. But there were two or three people doing something that was much more interesting than that. And one of them was Peter Usher, another was Derek Smith. They were working in Peter Usher in Banks Island, Derek Smith in Arkavik. So focus on the Western Arctic, that they were doing on the ground, long-term participant observation-based fieldwork with a view to writing reports that would inform government policy. Now, I think they were among the very first to be funded to do that. Now, there was a tradition in the department reaching further back, probably through Jeunesse and through Graham Rowley, who was the scientific advisor to the minister at the time, who had himself been an explorer, as you know, and sort of an expert on the Canadian Eastern Arctic. So there was an idea, I think, lurking around inside the department that scholarship or real on-the-ground knowledge was necessary and appropriate. And the Northern Science Research Group became the centre of that vision.
The a lot of these reports, though, there's an evolution of them from initially gently critiquing government to, by the late 60s and into the early 70s, being quite openly critical of government policies. How did this social research play out at the Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development?
Well, I think that the Northern Science Research Group constituted itself a bit like an academic department, and it was like that as a matter of everyday experience. I mean, they had sort of a library and a sort of coffee making area, and people sat around and talked, and it was if anyone ever worked in university, felt very university like, that it was embedded in the bureaucracy and had lots of bureaucratic dimensions. But and therefore there was a skeptical intellectual kind of quality to the place, which really led to questioning of policy, and I would say rather gentle critiquing of policy in the early days. But then Usher wrote his third volume of the Banks Island Report, where he took on the minister, who was Chrétien at the time, Jean Chrétien. He documented Chrétien, quote, misleading the people of Banks Island, unquote. That was directly critical, and that critical volume had to be approved, had to be signed off on by the senior bureaucrats, or Moose Kerr and Graham Rowley in particular, but Moose Kerr was the front person, so Moose Kerr signed off on it, as it were, on behalf of the minister. So you had the curious circumstance of a report being published under the signature of the minister that accused the minister of dissembling, is a kind word. And of course, Chrétien was extremely angry. And I think that at that point they decided this whole thing had to stop. They contacted me to say, don't come south. I remember getting that message when I was in the north. And if you do come south, don't come to the office. But then when I did come south and did criticize government policies, I encountered real hostility and closing down, and very quickly realized I had to leave. And I think that was the end. the end of the internal critical voice.
The Northern Science Research Group came to an end in 1973. But after this point, you and Peter Usher and a handful of others who had been involved and critiquing government through the NSRG, you all went and worked with Milton M. R. Friedman. I wanted to make sure we distinguish him from Milton Friedman, the economist, who was at McMaster. He's an anthropologist at McMaster, and he was leading the Inuit Land Use and Occupancy Project.
Yeah, that became the next part of my life, and I think it was the next really big piece of research going on in the Canadian North. And yeah, but Milton worked with Peter very closely on developing a concept of cultural mapping, which Peter piloted in the or test ran in the Mackenzie Delta. Then Milton, of course, hired a coordinator for each region, and Bill Kemp was South Baffin and also a more general coordinator, and I had North Baffin and Peter had the Western Arctic. But there was Carol Bryce Bennett and in the Central Arctic, and Fred Schwartz also. There were people who had not, and they had not. I mean, Bill Kemp had not had any really direct involvement with the Department of Indian Affairs, nor had Carol Bryce Bennett, as far as I know, nor Fred Schwartz. So I think Peter and I were probably the two who had been in the department, who then found ourselves in significant roles in the Inuit Land Use and Occupancy Project.
So you were largely been working in the Eastern Arctic at the time when political and economic power were really becoming entrenched in the Western Arctic. Was what was happening in the Eastern Arctic different than what was happening in the Western Arctic at that time?
The reason that they wanted me to go to the Eastern Arctic, they, again, Graham Rowley and Moose Kerr, their names have come up a lot because they were central figures in all this, I have to say, over many years. But I think Graham Rowley and Moose Kerr realized that there was no work being done in the Eastern Arctic that they were involved in anyway. There was very, very little anthropology being carried out in the Eastern Arctic, and there had been some area economic surveys. And they felt that there was an imbalance of information. And at the same time, especially Graham Rowley thought that the Eastern Arctic was where Inuit life was at its strongest. I mean, it was more isolated historically. It was much later in the history of the fur trade and the missionary frontiers that the Eastern Arctic was, as it were, colonized. And the Inuit lived on the land much later and were perhaps still living on the land in significant numbers in the early 70s. Whereas that was not true, as I understand it, in the Western Arctic. So I think the view was that the Eastern Arctic was little known, needed to be known better, and they wanted somebody to go there who would immerse themselves in the Eastern Arctic and carry the information back to Ottawa. I think that was the vision.
By the mid-1970s, the Inuit Land Use and Occupancy Research, the land claims work is really underway. The Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry coincided with this. It officially began in 1974, really didn't get rolling with the community hearings until 1975. Where were you when this was all getting started?
Okay, well, I was working away on the final stages of the Inuit Land Use and Occupancy Project reports. So I was putting together various bits of the very, very quite long and probably very significant essay on occupancy. It certainly was the piece that Milton Friedman was especially concerned about. Now, I was working on that in 73, 74, and hearing about the emergent Berger inquiry and hearing about the community hearings. So I wasn't involved in community hearings. And then I was asked by Peter Usher, who was coordinating the presentations to the Yellowknife hearings on behalf of COPE. So Peter Usher got in touch with me and said, would I do a paper for the COPE panels on the North, and a kind of overview of the North. And at the same time, Ed Wick, who was working for the Berger team, got in touch with me and said they would like me, the commission, the inquiry itself, would like me to also do a presentation on Inuit language, on languages of the North, and alcohol. Two different papers, two different presentations. So I ended up doing those three presentations at the Yellowknife hearings. That was my first involvement. And that led right away to Berger taking me to one side and saying that he would very much like me to continue to have some sort of relationship, that he was very, very interested, especially in the overview paper, I think. And then at the end of all the hearings, that was the only hearing I was involved in, Edwick got in touch with me and said, would I come to Ottawa and work with them on the preparation of the background to the report writing? So the inquiry, in fact, had a middle stage that's not often talked about. There was the community hearings as the first stage, and there was Tom and Berger and a team writing the report. But there was a middle stage where the inquiry team put together loads and loads of material. So they went through all the community hearing data, they put together background expert reports, and they prepared certain papers and to help inform the process. And they asked me to be part of the team that worked on that middle stage. And then when it came to the writing of the report, Tom Berger asked me to be part of his writing team. That was 77, I remember.
So
I remember that when I went to Ottawa to meet with the team working on this middle part of the process, I told them about the Inuit Land Use Occupancy Project and showed them the findings, and they were very, very, very intrigued by that. And they were very, very excited by it, I remember.
I have this quote that I came across from Tom Berger. In 1975, he wrote, "I have been guided by the conviction that this inquiry must be fair and it must be complete. We have got to do it right." What do you think it might have meant, getting it right at the time of the
inquiry? At the time, he said that in 75, so this is bang into the community hearings. I think that what he's thinking about here is there's got to be community hearings. I mean, the vision of the community hearings is at the center of, came to be at the center of the inquiry, and it's what excited everybody, and as you will know, it's what generated a lot of media coverage and made it a sort of a national phenomenon. And he was especially committed to the idea, I think very much influenced by the thinking of Michael Jackson and the vision of Michael Jackson, who went to live in the North on behalf of Berger, with the view that the hearing shouldn't have a time frame, and they should have a beginning but no end. So if it was going to be participatory, people had to be able to go on for as long as they needed to go on for. Whether that ideal was really put into practice, I don't know, but that was the ideal. And I remember Tom talking to me about this with great conviction and excitement. And I think that when he said, we've got to do this right, that's what he meant. But he also was a terrific believer in bringing in experts, people whose work he admired, people he thought who had a kind of intellectual sophistication or an academic credential that he himself lacked. And he is a great believer in finding and using other people's minds. And the part of getting it right would have been to do with that, I think.
Was there a guiding belief that this was for the public good?
Yeah, this was for the public good because the North is central. This is Tom Berger's view, right? The North is absolutely central to the Canadian identity. The morality of Canada, it was inseparable from how it dealt with its Indigenous populations. The Indigenous people of the North were at the point of asking for and were going to get a new deal with the country. The nation was going to make a new deal with the peoples of the North. Getting that right was, in Tom's view, central to the morality and integrity of Canada. He saw, I think, that he saw for a future for Canada in which it would lead the way in liberal progressive creations of justice within a capitalist democracy. He might not have put it quite like that, but it's not far from how he would have put it, I think.
He'd been at the center of some fairly significant legal cases involving Aboriginal title and Aboriginal law,
Yeah.
and really one of probably at the time a handful of lawyers or justices who really had some kind of in-depth understanding of the legal issues as well. But it was also at a time when many people in government and the public did not have this language. They did not have the belief or the understanding that Indigenous people had rights.
That's right. Yeah. Niska case that Tom was a leading counsel for the Niska in the case, which began, it went first to trial in 1968, I think, and was in the court from 68 to 73.
73, January 73.
For those 5 years, Canada is adjudicating the question of Aboriginal title. Tom is at the centre of that adjudication for those 5 years. I mean, so I think Canada was being informed about this question, and Tom was playing a big part in it, and he himself was getting informed. Though he didn't, the Niska case didn't rely on anything like community hearings, and if I recall rightly, Wilson Duff gave all the evidence that was given on the nature of the Niska cultural and economic system. That evidence wasn't led by the Niska themselves. It was led by an anthropologist who presented the evidence on their behalf, and it was all given in one day, I believe. So Tom made a huge journey from the kind of process that the Niska case involved in 68-69 to what he was going to do in the community hearings in the Mackenzie Valley in 1974-75. It's not that much later.
How much of the structure of the inquiry, or how much of the, and we'll get to the report in a second, but how much of this was motivated by this attempt to get these issues out there to the public?
Well, I think that was a. Are you asking, was that part of what Tom Berger was thinking about?
With
Yeah.
the, in terms of structuring the inquiry the way he did, at the scale that he did.
Yeah, but I think that he was excited by that possibility as a result of the way the inquiry unfolded. I think that as the media picked up on the inquiry, as he realized what a huge or how huge the interest was in the inquiry, he's more and more saw that it should be taken across the whole of Canada, hence his embracing the idea of and putting in place hearings in the major cities of the country in the south. So there's no longer a question about the nature of the north, there's a question about the nature of Canada and what was Canada's relationship going to be to Indigenous peoples and development. So it became an inquiry that was of which the whole country was involved, and Tom very much wanted that. He wanted to get that out to the country. I don't think that's what was his thinking in the early days. In the beginning, I think he was focused on getting the process right for the people of the North, so the inquiry would have genuine, it would have a genuine validity. It would represent the views of the people. He would really listen to them. But getting it out to the nation as a whole, I think, grew as a vision, as the inquiry got underway.
We talked recently about taking time. This is something that you sort of settled on is really a really important piece of the inquiry, the way that the process, which was taking the time. How was taking time important to getting it right in the way that Berger might have desired?
I'll go back to the idea of hearings that were open-ended. Within each hearing, you listen to the person and they spoke for as long as they wanted. It didn't matter if they spoke in their own language, they had to provide the time for the interpreting. There was a taking of time within the hearings and in relation to the planning of the hearings. And Tom just took the view that it would take however long it took. And I remember him saying that it didn't matter what it cost. I mean, this just was how it was going to be. The time had to be taken and had to be paid for. But behind this, there was also a taking of time that was to do perhaps with Michael Jackson's role. So he didn't just consult Michael Jackson to advise on the nature of the Aboriginal title and the issue of the law. He got Michael and his family to go and live in the Mackenzie Valley for an extended period of time, very long, for months on end. They lived there, and then Tom could draw on Michael's insight and connections, which had been built up over long periods of time. And I think that, to some extent, Tom's response to my work and his wish to draw me in was to do with the time I had spent. I'd been living in the north for a long period of time and very immersed, and I had been taking time. So by bringing me in, just like bringing Michael in, once he had, he was getting our spending of time into the findings, into his writing as well. He was also prepared to spend a lot of time writing the report, and he did indeed spend the time and worked on it sort of paragraph by paragraph, page by page.
But you were this is you were asked to be by Bridget to be part of the team that drafted Volume One, which is the substantive volume of Northern Frontier, Northern Homeland. What was the process of actually outlining and writing that report, this middle phase that you alluded to before?
So Tom took materials that were prepared by his team in what I call the middle phase of the work, and he looked at it all, and he wrote a draft, a first draft of the report himself, completed himself, and he then sent that draft to me. He asked me to read his draft of the report and then come to Vancouver. I was back teaching in Cambridge then, so I said to leaving and coming to Vancouver on New Year's Eve 76 77, and I sat in the airplane reading this draft, which was pretty rough. I mean, I was incredulous. I was incredulous. I remember I started marking it up, and then I thought, it's beyond marking up this report. So I went to his house on, it must have been January the 1st or 2nd, sat in his basement, and I plucked up courage and I said, you know, I think you're going to have to start again. Some intellectual issues that are just completely unresolved. From the point of view of the socioeconomic side of it, which I was especially interested in, I said, you have not resolved the question that emerged. There's a big question that emerged in the course of the inquiry about what the shape of economic development in the North does look like and ought to look like. There was a point of view put forward by some experts. I think they were led by Arctic Gas, but anyway, by the pipeline companies who hired them, who said that the inevitable and natural process of social economic life in the North is towards industrial labour. That's what we have to anticipate. That was a kind of way of continuating the old acculturation theory, really, but slightly more sophisticated. And on the other hand, the people, the voice from the communities, predominantly saying, there's a completely other model for northern development, which would be rooted in what I've often called the mixed economy, but would be led by people's relationship to the land and heritage. And that would resist incorporation into the industrial labour market rather than welcome it. And his response was a complete terrific enthusiasm. He was very, very excited. So then he started inviting me and to draft, to take his draft and then redraft it and redraft it and redraft it. And so he and I became a kind of, Tom Burge and I became a sort of writing team. So I would draft stuff and give it to him, and then he would sit next to me, and we'd go through it, and he would have made lots of suggestions, and then there was more redrafting, and we got to a fairly good first draft of the whole. And then he set up a team, and that worked in Ottawa, not in Vancouver, then moved the whole thing to Ottawa. And set up a team in Ottawa. We sat around a table, and they brought in Alan Cook as an editor. And we had, I mean, Michael Jackson at the table, Ed Wick, I think, often at the table. And we just went through it paragraph by paragraph by paragraph as a group. And that we'd work on it through for several hours, and that would lead to the need for certain bits to be rewritten or bits that way. But that's done, they have to be incorporated, and I would go off, and others would go off and draft or work on bits, and Tom would work on bits, and then be integrated, and then the next draft would be produced, and we'd work on that, and it was we worked like that for day in, day out, day in. I mean, incredibly long hours. I remember Tom being completely exhausted, and I was about the toughest work process, one of the toughest work processes I've ever been through. But it was very exciting, I have to say. It was informed by and sustained by a sense of tremendous excitement.
The report itself, I mean, Northern Frontier, Northern Homeland, Volume 1, it doesn't read like a government commission report. It's got photographs. It's presented in language that is accessible. Was there always a sense that this was going to have some public purchase?
I think that Tom was always opposed to acronyms, bureaucraties of any kind. He liked writing. He was very interested in writing, and he liked clarity. And then the design idea was an extension of that. There should be pictures, and it should be very, very accessible. Volume one was written to be read. Now, he didn't at the from the he didn't think he was going to find a publisher to publish it. He wanted it to be beautifully presented. He wanted it to look like something people would want to read, and that they would quickly be able to get to grips with it. It wasn't that he thought, I've got to dumb this down in some way at all. On the contrary, he kind of wanted intellectual sophistication, but he wanted it to be a very of a literate form rather than a scholarly form, if that's the distinction that makes sense here. And of course, it's very scholarly, and it's constantly referencing the voice of the community hearings. But he didn't want it to be academic or bureaucratic in tone. He wanted it to be a piece of writing that would make people want to read it.
It became for a long time, and quite probably until the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report, it was the largest, the best-selling government publication, which I don't know how many, I don't know how many versions of the Glasgow Commission report were ever sold. But what point did you did it sort of catch on that this was becoming part of the popular conversation?
I knew while we were working on it that it was part of the popular conversation, because every time I went to visit friends or had a day off and spent time hanging out with friends in Ottawa, everybody was talking about it. I mean, what was he going to say? What was it going to be? And of course, the media were CBC had been very focused on it. There was a lot of media attention that would sustain long enough anyway through this writing process for there to be a public consciousness. And when it came to the release, I remember the lockup was a hugely tense and big deal. It was a big deal, the lockup, huge media coverage, and it became part of a public awareness.
I want to shift then, with that in mind, is to think about the legacy of the lasting impacts of the inquiry. For me, there remains a discrepancy between how the inquiry is imagined at a popular level and what its significance was on the ground. And I'm thinking especially for the political evolution of the Northwest Territories. We think about the Dene movement, especially because this is the pipeline through Dene land. By the end of the community hearings, many of the Inuit, Inuvialuit, Métis, and Dene organizations were all pursuing separate land claims proposals. The Métis had formalized and they'd changed their position around pipeline development. Do you feel that the inquiry achieved the kind of broader transformation that has been popularly imagined or attributed to it?
Of course, I wasn't spending time in the Mackenzie Valley or in the Western Arctic. So our consciousness evolved on the ground is something I don't know a lot about directly. Now, nationally, in the immediate aftermath, it had a very big effect on the subsequent inquiry, the Lissick inquiry in 77, and the Mayer inquiry. Bought the Berger model to some extent. There was a sense that if you were going to look at any project that was being put forward for the North, you had to follow a kind of a Bourgeois model, and that people had to have their say. And so if we're looking at, you know, inquiries, the history of inquiries in Canada, maybe could be made for saying the Bourgeois had a very long history, they had a long shadow, but not long enough, would be my view.
Not long enough.
Not long enough. And when it came to Site C in British Columbia, or liquid natural gas pipelines across the Northern Gateway project, I don't have a sense there's been anything like the inquiry process that Bourgeois would have required or asked for, or his legacy would have asked for. So that's at the level of inquiries. But your question is probably about something that's another level, whether the whole atmosphere in the North was affected by Bourgeois. And I think, yes, the answer would be to a considerable extent in relation to land claims, and that the Bourgeois process gave confidence to the Dene voice. It probably gave confidence to Nuvialuit. And although they, as you were saying, they sought to negotiate and did negotiate their separate deals, the fact that they did so with great energy and confidence, and that they were, of course, paying very close attention to the indigenous economy and the right to manage certain core lands, I think a lot of that would have been fueled by or given confidence by the hearings process and all that that meant within each community. But then the world shifted, didn't it? I mean, that the pro-development voice within Indigenous communities got louder and more organized, and that meant that something else was happening across the North that we could talk about. But I suspect that that changed the meaning of Bourgeois in a way. It went from being a mirror of northern reality, or a window, maybe a better metaphor is under a window or a set of windows of what is real about the North, into becoming a piece of history. A window of what people thought then, or what the argument was then. I'm not the person to speak to this. I haven't been a part of the argument, so I haven't been on the ground for the last decade or more, and so, I mean, 20 years even. So, I think I can't speak to what it's like on the ground at all, but certainly I talked to Peter Usher a great deal at the time of the review panel in 2002, and he was very struck by the change, the kind of the rethink about what the North means to Indigenous people. Yeah, but what do you think?
Well, you know, my introduction to the North, my introduction to the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry, was it's sort of a central reference point or a way in for people who are not from the North to begin to understand the complexity of the North, or to understand some of the dynamics that shaped the North during this particular time. But I followed the, I was especially interested in the Dene movement. And from a Southern perspective, the pipeline inquiry is the dominant event. And in many ways it is. It really is quite, it is a seminal event in Canadian social and political history. But it was also an event that required a lot of energy from the Dene movement, a tremendous amount of coordination, speaking with people in the communities and really attempting to educate them about the land claim process, because this was a very new process for many people. And at the time, the Dene process was to come up with a single land claim for Dene Day, a united Dene Day within the Northwest Territories. And it was an enormous challenge. The geographic scope is huge, different Dene languages being spoken. There were significant generational differences. You see this playing out at the inquiry, and really attempting to use the inquiry as this platform to reach a broader audience. And I think that they were very successful at doing that. But the promise of the land claims was never realized. It took many years more than than what was outlined in the report. I think Berger called for a 10-year moratorium. There are still land claims negotiations ongoing. The Nuvialawit were the only to sign within that 10-year period. That was 1984 they signed. And the next claim was not concluded, I think, until 1991, 92, the Gwich'in claim, followed by the Saatu and Nunavut. And that sense of unity that is so strong throughout the mid-1970s, by the end of the decade, the different indigenous groups are competing with one another over land. And in the NWTU especially, the Berger inquiry wraps up. And the first thing the government in the Northwest Territories does, they launch this Drury Commission into government in the Northwest Territories, which pays no attention to anything that was recommended. So I think I wonder about it at these different scales. I think I'm very much part of the national conversation. In the North, I wonder, and I'm interested to speak to people there too, and I've spoken to many people there, but I wonder if it's had the same lasting legacy and if people feel that the promise has been realized. And it's not to say that the promise came from Tom Berger himself.
No,
I
it
don't think.
didn't. Yeah, I was just thinking that because the promise came from the voices in the community, and it was an in-principle promise, if it's a promise. If promise is the right word, and the principle was that the land is the people, and that their relationship to the land is them, and the land needs them just as they need it, and that's a kind of a holistic vision of what Indigenous life is and what the North should be, and that within that you have to work out how you're going to allow and moderate and manage and mitigate or prevent development. But that's very, it is holistic and generalized, I think. And that, of course, once you look at the kind of policies you've been describing, that people can go on mouthing those generalized, those high order in principle generalities, and the environmental movement has latched on to some of them as well. There's another sort of force at work that comes from outside the North, uses that vision. But yeah, I think it's subverted. I think you're right, by the failure of the land claims process to deliver specifically what people were hoping it would deliver on the ground, community by community, the inherent problem of trying to have a Dinande-wide land claim when you've got different cultures, different kinds of voice, and then the split between the West and the East may be relevant here as well.
I seem to remember when we spoke years ago that you had talked about when you were writing Maps and Dreams, you'd spent about a year and a half up in the northeastern part of British Columbia. But you described it as that book was not just a reflection of your experience in BC. It had been part of an attempt for you to reflect upon your longer experience around land claims research and some of the work you've been doing since you first arrived in 1969. So, on a personal level, what has stayed with you about your time working with the inquiry?
This is a very, very interesting question. See, what when I think back to what was so compelling about working with inquiry, I realize how much faith I had in benevolent bureaucracy, and that it's a very, very outmoded view, but it was very strong at the time, that many a view held by many was that we could look to government to make things a hell of a lot better and secure people's well-being in the long term. That government, if government got this right, it could be right. I mean, to go back to the Berger saying, we need to get this right. Well, if government gets this right, this will be right for the people. And I think that was a huge part of my belief system of the inquiry. And that continued through my working on Maps and Dreams, and certainly my writings about the North and my involvement in government and trying to influence government policy, and then writing of Maps and Dreams. But that belief in benevolent bureaucracy didn't sustain, and possibly it was in the latter stages of working on Maps and Dreams that I began to realize that there had to be a completely different kind of voice in this. And it wasn't the voice of people like me, and it wasn't the voice even of people like Tom Berger. The voice had to come from leadership in the communities. I think that Berger was very, very exciting at the time, but it's lost its hold on me, I think, other than as a model for an inquiry. If you're going to have an inquiry, then you better do it like that. But I came to be caught up in the courts. Some of the really important issues were being resolved not by inquiries but by legal cases, and I was obviously picking up on the thread of the Calder case, then through a series of cases, particularly in British Columbia, and then Delgamuukw that I was involved in, and then right through to more recently the Blueberry First Nation case in British Columbia. So I think that legal cases were in the foreground of what I find myself working on, and where I could be an under-labourer to actions that were led by the people themselves. So Delgamuukw was led by the Gik-San Wet'suwet'en, and Blueberry First Nation case was absolutely led by the Blueberry view of the world and the grievances that they were there, that were theirs and not, that didn't come from outside them. And that's a very different kind of intellectual and research territory. I think it's pretty different. And that means in a way that Berger was not so much in my mind. Also, then I gave myself to filmmaking much more. And film is an extraordinary tool when it comes to Indigenous people and research with oral cultures, because film is the ideal way of capturing oral culture, ironically. Oral culture is about speaking. In fact, oral culture is about performance. And you only capture performance on film. You can't capture it in a transcribed tape recording. So I realized that if my role in life was to give voice to, or be a medium, as it were, for Indigenous voices, then film was the way I wanted to do it. Again and again, I had this sense that what I was doing with film was listening and then sharing the listening. I'm not interpreting. I'm not analyzing. I'm not saying, well, let's look at the debate between two visions of development, or I'm not saying, let's see where this fits into Marxist understandings of history. I'm saying, listen, just listen.
You've seen how the North is imagined in Canada. You've experienced the North intimately. You've lived there. You've learned to speak two dialects of Inuktitut. You've written extensively about your experiences, including in your recent memoir, Landscapes of Silence. Do you think this idea of North and the way it was popularly imagined and accepted in the 1970s holds true for Canada today?
Yes, I think across quite a wide range of Canadians, the North is still a place of potential and magic, and which potential and magic includes Indigenous life, and the kind of relationship to land and resources that is of increasing value to many, many people. So I think the idea of North is still very strong, and certainly whenever I was giving lectures or talks or showing films about the North in southern British Columbia, which is the only part of the South I've done it in at all recently, there's a sort of excitement in the room. Excitement that they're going somewhere that's very special, that it's sort of slightly beyond what they know, but it's part of who Canada is, and it has all kinds of value and importance that they probably can't even quite put words on. But I think if they could put words on it, and when they did put words on it, they would, those words would include space, healthy environment, strong Indigenous cultures, things that I think Canadians feel are hugely important to Canada, for all that they've come under attack and become compromised by aggressive development and modernities of various kinds.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for doing this. It's very, very good for me.